Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Adrian Mean, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello.
Brian Brushwood.
Hello. Hopefully we won't get struck by lightning. It's very thundery outside.
Well, that's all up to the next man, Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, I'm here. Thankfully, we didn't used to have this like a year ago, but we have a little power supply system. So if stuff breaks down, we can save some of the stuff.
Yeah, no, it used to be like we were flying without a net at all times.
Yeah. So if you hear
that
a beeping,
that's necessity in Florida was the power supply thing because of the lightning strikes and all that. You know, if you didn't have a UPS attached to your computer system, it was like, I don't know, not using penicillin.
Yeah, you're just trying to raw dog the internet.
Hey, man, Either you have a UPS or you say, oops.
Oh. Yeah.
See what I did there?
Yeah.
That says free marketing advice. Yeah. I know I should have saved that for after things.
You should have saved that for the bumper stickers that you're stuck with a whole warehouse full of unsold. You either use a UPS or say oops bumper stickers.
You could sell that to the United Postal Service.
Yeah, either way.
Mint on that, yeah.
Yeah.
Or to Pixar.
So I want to jump right into the next story. Pardon me.
Sleepy boy.
Sorry. I just get so tired of reading this. World's most powerful rocket's going to launch tonight. The Falcon Heavy, where they recover all three boosters. Yada, yada, yada.
Now, hold on. There's plenty to be excited about this time, Andrew, because for the first time, they're deploying, I believe it's seven different satellites in seven different orbits. Is that right?
They're launching multiple payloads, and I'm kind of excited because I helped back one of these payloads.
Oh, wow. Like, was it a Kickstarter?
Yep, for the Planetary Society for the light sail.
And the light sail is testing for the ability to use solar sails as a method of propulsion between the planets and stars?
Yes, sir. So the Planetary Society funded a mission on Kickstarter, of which, again, I've got the T-shirt. And what it is they want to test exactly that. They have a CubeSat that's going to be one of the – and this is not the most important payload. Well, it is to me. But basically, if you go to the planetary.org, you can see a video of this. And it's really awesome as you see how the thing unfurls and whatnot. They have an animation that plays, I think, on the main planetary.org site. And you can see the thing unfurling and whatnot. And they're going to give this – I think this is the version 2, and they're improving upon the last one, which I think had some deployment issues. And so this is going to be one of the many cool things going on with this.
This is it's a CubeSat, tiny satellite, and all it's going to do is robotically extend some arms to the casual observer. It looks like tinfoil, but it's, you know, some kind of space mylar or whatever. And
all
I guess
all it's going to do – for those of us that don't have our own show like Modern Rogue where we push the boundaries every day.
No. What I'm saying – look, don't misunderstand simple for extraordinary. I mean the two are not mutually exclusive. I assume that what they're doing is just unfurling a big sail, and then they get to just measure how well it works by catching and riding the solar winds.
That's the plan. That's the plan is to deploy this into sea. Solar sails have the advantage of – you don't really need to have any fuel unless you want to have some small fuel or you want to have some little ion thruster to help you steer a bit and take advantage, as you pointed out, the solar winds. And you can get up to significant velocities. You know, you could, you know, escape velocity for the solar system, et cetera. And so it's a very interesting way to try to do this. We have new, really, really cool new materials that are extremely lightweight, yet pretty strong and very reflective and able to, you know, capture that. And so this is going to be a cool test of this.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, when we get to a post-scarcity society where AI robots are able to build other AI robots and we could just sort of issue one directive. Let's say we're at a place where all humans could be fed and taken care of and medicined to the extent that they all want to be. And meanwhile, you are able to have entire planets being harvested by robots or whatever. It makes sense to, if we're at a place where we wanted to – reach out beyond the stars. I guess I'm trying to think of like a mega Voyager possibility on this, mm-hmm. where for 1,000 years, robots do nothing but build, you know, version 89.5 of the golden record, stick it on these things, and then just let the solar winds carry it out to the stars. In so many ways, we would be just doing what a dandelion does.
Yep. Yep. I mean, that's once you get the cost down low enough, and, you know, you can just continuously send things out and explore. And that's kind of a very exciting thing. And the accessibility, like, this is privately funded. You know, this is the Planetary Society is funding a, you know, a deep space mission. Now, granted, you're like, oh, well, it's only, you know, it's a tiny little thing. But, like, well, this is where it starts, folks.
Sure, yeah.
And is this one of the 7 satellites, or are all 7 satellites different light sails?
I think there's many more than 7 satellites, but there are 7 different orbits that they have to hit, including some of some really far out ones that are used for military purposes. So that basically the success of this, if I'm remembering the article correctly, the success of this mission will directly affect whether or not they get one of the 2 lucrative contracts, military contracts for the next however many years with the Air Force. It's like them versus ULA versus, you know, Boeing and so on. Or I guess Boeing.
Yeah, that's the real missions launching government hardware in there. This is just a sort of little bonus. Like, hey, yeah, I've got a, you know, front seat's empty. You want it? You
know? Yeah, they are basically, on one hand, the real money is in those contracts. It's like a freight program, but they also want to be Uber pool, where people can, you know, spend a far lower amount of money and take advantage of the fact that these rockets are taken off at a very regular clip. And that also saves money, theoretically, for the government. They're able to offer a more competitive rate because, theoretically, it would be cheaper to do.
A correction on my numbers. It's 24 different payloads on 3 different orbits. And that's significant because they're going to release however many on the first one, and then they have to restart the engine a second time, and then a third time, and then, of course, I guess will they bring back home the second stage? Are we at that point yet?
Oh, the upper stage?
Yeah.
No.
Okay, so then, but
this burn, because it's going so much further out. It's. The upper stage is going to probably most likely definitely do a burn up in the atmosphere.
Wow.
And not only crash into the ocean, but, like, you know, like smash.
Though apparently, nothing by then. This is the first time the Air Force is allowing its payloads to be on previously used rockets. So it's kind of the other side.
Man, that's crazy.
Yeah.
that's amazing that it's like, all right, well, once you normalize the idea that, like, all right, well, we are reusing rockets and SpaceX is kind of the only game in town for that, then that's huge. Because if they're willing to do that, then you have unlocked a huge competitive advantage.
Yep. So in other news, this is a follow-up on a story from we covered, I think, the week before, and I don't know, good news, bad news. Remember how we talked about the Strato launch looked like they were kind of going out of business?
Yeah, on account of having nothing but a crazy spruce goose plane to show for it.
Well, a plane that's for sale.
Oh, my God. Well, I don't know.
The world's largest airplane can be yours for about the budget of, I don't know, a Justice League movie with reshoots.
Oh, man. Could you imagine being in a position that doesn't go to a private collector, right? Do you think somebody figures out a use for this thing?
We've got a bid in from Iran.
Oh, jeez.
Well, that's the problem, is that who wants to, because, like, I think they're asked like $400 million and, or, you know, like, okay, who wants to drop $400 million plus God knows how much more to maintain and keep this thing going, versus if you said, well, we're really into the idea of it depends. You're really buying up. You really want to be, I think you want to buy a program, you know?
Yeah.
Cause it's a one-off, and one-offs are, you need to, It's not like you just get this thing and it runs. There's a lot of maintenance, a lot of other things going on.
I think Lawn Makes has it in the chat. We just need to ask if they'll take a suit of armor in trade, because if you'd, if we're trading cool crap, I mean, we got some cool crap.
Yeah.
Yes, Brian, though, just imagine the shipping on that, though.
That, that's what's gonna get you. Turns out you're like, well, just fly it on over. They're like, oh, no. You're going to have to pack it up and ship it.
Yeah. Brian hires another task rabbit to see what it's going to cost from the pack and ship and down the street.
47 helicopters are just lifting up this giant UPS box.
That is a big weird, man. That is wild. But I'm curious to see if it does sell, because like you guys said, it's too expensive to just kind of like buy and, like, you know, have hanging out somewhere, but it's not quite what you would want for that kind of money if you were trying to get into the space game.
Well, and that's the thing, is nobody except for the people who did would choose this from scratch as their first option to solve any number of problems. And then, in other words, whatever thing you would want to do with this, almost certainly there would be cheaper, more cost-effective ways to do that thing than even buying at pennies on the dollar of investment this particular piece of history.
Yeah, the advantage of this is, we've talked about before, the strato launch plane is capable of putting rockets into multiple orbits, and there are advantages to that strategy. But yeah, but it's like, you know, when you're looking at $500 million investment, and you're like, yeah, do I do that, or, you know, if I'm an aerospace company, do I just put that money into my own rapidly reusable technology and go that way? Because, you know, here's the problem with this thing too, is you got one airplane, this thing crashes, there ain't going to be another.
Oof. I'm sure it's easy to get insurance on that kind of thing too, right?
Yeah, exactly. Replacement value. We'll see. I don't know. I mean, who knows? You know, and apparently Richard Branson offered to buy it for $1.
Oh. Get in the game. Just get in the game.
I mean, that is a savvy opening bid, I'm not going to lie. Was it Peter Thiel's book, 0 to 1? Apparently he had just read that.
Nailed it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, here's the strategy to that, is that it's one of these things where you're like, oh, well, you know, what's the value of this? Well, right now it's taking up space. It's costing, you know, Strato Launch and the people in charge of Vulcan Ventures, which is the parent company of all that, are looking at line items of how much this thing costs. You know, what's it going to cost every year for maintenance, or what's it going to cost every year to keep this thing, and et cetera. And there's a point at some point in the future where you go, that cost far exceeds whatever value you think you're going to recoup. And, you know, things happen like that. People come in and, you know, do lowball offers on stuff before. Like,
oh, and think
I
about,
think Branson tried to buy the Concorde, the remaining Concordes, when they were going to pull those out of service.
I have another wrinkle on this that I don't think we've tied together. So it's like, in our mind, I think we can all imagine maybe 100 or 1,000 multi-billionaires that might do this as a vanity thing, but there's another external pressure in that over the last 10 to 15 years, it's become very fashionable, if you're a multi-billionaire, to try to out-donate the rest of your crowd. And that's the new status symbol. So it's like, now you have to think to yourself, okay, do I want to be the badass who spent $400 million on a plane that will probably never fly? Or do I want to be the badass that spent $400 million on this cause that now this disease is eradicated in my name? And all of a sudden that makes this an even less attractive offer.
Yeah, I think that the biggest issue is just figuring out exactly what you're going to do with it. And that's why, like, a dollar purchase of the hardware is interesting if there's at least a commitment to do something and there's a commitment to keep it going. I don't think it's you know, as insulting as somebody might initially think, to be like, oh, really, they want $400 million? He's offering $1? Because if he's actually going to do something with it, then that's good. I mean, I think that's ultimately what the spirit of that project would thrive on.
Yeah, well, you know what? I hadn't thought about that as it being a semi-serious thing, which is, by a $1 bid, I would say in the entire planet, the most natural fit to buy this and to actually use it would be Richard Branson, because this could be retrofitted with the Spaceship One design.
Well, they had plans. They were actually going to work on – they had an agreement with Strato Launch actually to develop hardware to fly on.
So a $1 bid essentially becomes a real way to communicate, I have genuine interest. Your initial offer is crazy. Let's talk.
Yeah. And that's what – who knows? Who knows how this kind of – I don't think any of us move in the kind of circles that a $400 million massive mega plane that could bring you access to space these conversations are being had in. But, if someone is looking to continue the mission, then absolutely. In for $2?
Let me correct this. It wasn't Virgin Galactic. Again, there things changed. The Virgin Galactic wasn't who they were going to launch. Virgin Galactic was looking to build their own much larger space plane too at some point, I believe. But Orbital ATK, so that was, I think, who was going to – they wanted to use it with. And then I think Aerojet Rocketdyne. So there's a couple of these other companies that were planning to put payloads on them. That might be who they were sort of kind of like – floating us out there too.
Maybe this is just a an anchoring tactic to make sure that the at some point I'll bet this does sell. You guys want to lock in our prices, right, guesses as to what it goes for?
I think that it'll be hard to sort of put a specific price on it, because it'll probably be like some sort of partnership agreement with whoever is most further along and wanted to use it between like Rocketdyne or Orbital ATK.
Because you probably would want to acquire all the talent that was in the creation and maintenance and running of it.
And it might be like a profit sharing agreement or whatever, like a new, and basically if you're the people trying to handle Vulcan Ventures, you're like, we want to get this off the books. And we want, if we can declare revenue positive, whatever, they can say, okay, you guys are in charge of a new venture. We own 40% of whatever profits are yielded from it, blah, 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 And then you write off the value or whatever.
Yeah.
And there was also another too, which was Stratolaunch was working on, apparently never built though, was Black Ice, which was going to be their own basically space shuttle sized orbiter craft that was supposed to be able to launch from there.
Oh, wow.
Which... there's a lot of intellectual property there that has value. So, it just – the price is pretty hefty.
It is interesting how little price matters when you factor in all the other negotiating points there are. Like I didn't consider the potential to continue to participate in the profits or revenues of whoever acquires it going forward. And like at some point, some number of talented engineers thrown into the deal on an ongoing basis – you end up at a place where $400 million seems like a fine price tag, but I don't know that they even have enough of that talent to include in the deal.
Well, I think this is a crazy thing. You want to know what else is crazy? Everybody who supports us at patreon.com/weirdthings. Now, don't get all fired up. When I say crazy, I don't mean mentally disturbed. I mean enthusiastic about this kind of off-kilter science discussion that we have minted on Weird Things, the podcast and live stream. Folks, head on over there right now, patreon.com/weirdthings, and make sure that we keep coming back each and every Monday morning, giving you the kind of scientific and news of the weird talk that you crave. patreon.com/weirdthings is also where you can get our After Things podcast before anybody else. We talk about all the projects that not only we are working on, but also you guys can email in as well. Head on over and chat us up. patreon.com/weirdthings.
You know what's cool about that is you can do that at any time you want. Sooner's better than later, but you want to go, donate now, support us later, whatever. It's cool. You can do this anytime you want, except maybe... if you're living in the Norwegian town of Sommerøy, the island.
Oh.
Heard about this town?
No. I mean, anytime I hear the word Norway, my ears perk up, because my fondest memories were the year and a half I lived there.
Right. Brian's from there in a way.
I mean, when we got my genetic profile, I'm about a quarter Scandinavian.
Me too, man.
Yay, right on.
Brian, is that you?
Ah, my brother!
There's a town that wants to abolish time in Norway. They're above the Arctic Circle, so like they get a period of like, I don't know, when like the sun don't set and stuff.
Okay, hold on. Give one second. Just give me a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Two branches. My brain is split in two.
Oh no, I can tell, Brian. You are there's a roiling turmoil within you, because like on one hand, there is a deep excitement for a world without time, but then almost immediately you now are thinking of all the reservations that you would have. So talk it out.
Yeah. Okay. So on the positive side, where the sun is shining all the time or it's night all the time, it doesn't make a lot of sense to tell. And keep in mind, times that I hate time is when I've just pulled a 18-hour all-night shift. It's 7 in the morning. I'm catching a flight and would love to, at the end of an 18-hour workday, have an adult beverage. But guess what? Old time sticking its thumb in my eye, telling me that I'm the weirdo for trying to order a gin and tonic at 7 in the morning. You're the one with the problem, not me. So yes, 100% abolish time. Mow your lawn whenever you want. Hells yeah, man. It's a free country, I assume. But on the flip side, it makes me think about the reason we have time to begin with. Time as we know it really didn't exist until there were train schedules to keep. There were no time zones before the train stations, because there was no need to synchronize one area from the other. Every town had their own local noon. And as a result, I don't know what that means in terms of appointment keeping or whatever. But I mean, I kind of dig the punk rock anarchist vibe of this. Justin, where are you at?
All right, look. I don't want to be the old school marm here, just taking the flights of fancy and deconstructing them. But, Brian, let me put you in a situation. Let's say you're on one of those 18-hour days, except this time you finally make it back to your home. You've talked on the internet a bunch about how sometimes hard it is to get to sleep, right? Some of us are quicker sleepers than others, and I know from our friendship that Every wink of sleep that you get personally is precious. So let's say you are laying your head down, you're drifting off to sleep, and you are just now entering the first dream of the night, when all of a sudden, your neighbor wants to cut his lawn. It's 4 o'clock in the morning, and now you're like woken up because he has freedom and you do not. There is a benefit for us synchronizing when certain things are appropriate to do. I feel like we are throwing the baby out with the bathwater here.
I don't know that you could have picked a worst example, because what you described is my life right now, today, as they build an apartment complex a scant 200 yards from my house. And you will never believe, Justin, what time those pneumatic drills start running. That's right, friends. 4 in the GD morning is when the place lights up like they found the monolith on the moon, and the beeping and the driving around and the flashing begins. It's already your living nightmare is my current reality. So I'm going to say, can't get much worse than this.
Well, yes, it could go on forever. That would be the only thing that
would
got worse.
Look, man, I'm gonna, you know what? Spend a few $1,000 on a isolation tank. Hey, I'll be fine if I get to call my own shots on my schedule. That'd be okay.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we would probably just evolve out of it. We would just like be more into a world where, in fact, there are some headphones that I ordered from Kickstarter, like. It was a solid, like, it was years before I left the Go Game when I was traveling all the time. But they were something that I really want, which are soft noise-canceling headphones. So they are, like, the good, like, noise-canceling things, but they were cloth and soft. So when you're sleeping on a plane, you don't have that, like, you know, a big plastic thing kind of hitting the plastic side or whatever. But I guess we would just have those. Those would just take off. The idea that you are just putting yourself into a coma or whatever.
Yeah, you know, I nowadays my latest sleeping jam is to put in earplugs and then put in over-the-ear noise-canceling headphones, which is almost enough for me to
wrap my tape, my face with tape like a mentalist.
I mean, yeah. I mean, well, and what happens is that's
$100 over my eye.
That's quiet enough that I don't hear, you know, shuffling and dogs and the tree occasionally tapping against the window or whatever. And
have then, you tried like real earplugs?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Are real earplugs.
I mean, not earbuds. I mean,
no, did I say earbuds? I meant earplugs. The, yeah.
Gotcha.
Like earplugs and then noise canceling headphones over it. And then sometimes I could still barely hear something on the other side of the house or whatever, in which case maybe just a little bit of white noise, until I'm at that point where I drift off and I wake up just long enough to realize it'd be more comfortable if this was not on my head, and then off it goes, and I'm able to sleep for a bit.
Andrew, what do you say to the abolishment of time?
I'm just wondering how far away is Brian from asking for Michael Jackson's former doctor's number?
Not gonna lie, there was like a part of me that deeply understood the one. Although there's different types of sleep, and anesthetic sleep is bad sleep because you don't dream and you don't enter REM or any of that. It's not restful in the way
sometimes
real sleep.
Not dreaming's a benefit, Brian. probably if you're that guy. So listen, I'm a guy that lives, I have one day a week I use an alarm clock unless I have an appointment with a doctor or, you know, something, an early phone call. Guess what day of the week that I set my alarm?
Today.
Mondays. Today.
Yeah.
Today. Monday is alarm clock day for me. Okay. So this is what I do. I go to bed when I want to. I wake up when I want to. Right. I mean, like people like I have engineered my life to have this now. I cohabitate now, and so I have somebody else with their own sort of, you know, schedule who's probably a much more responsible person than I am, which means that, you know, now I might like wake up at like 9 a.m. or something, or 8 a.m. or 7 a.m. because of an alarm, and then I'll go back to sleep, and I've adjusted. I sleep deeply. I'm a light sleeper, but I always sleep pretty well, but I'm an intermittent sleeper. You know, I'll sleep for 3 hours, I'll get up, I'll do something, I'll go back to sleep, sleep another 4 hours, and then be fine. So I live as timeless as you can, in a sense. But, you know, it's great to get rid of time until two people have to meet up and do something.
Yeah. Oh, no, totally. I'm sure that there is probably a collected a full 24 hours of Andrew annoyed waiting for me because I said I was going to be over at his house 30 minutes before I actually showed up, that I would have preferred a world without time so I wouldn't just be the a-hole showing up late.
There's a thing when you read through the article about this, they talk about like – they say like, well, it'd be great if stores would be open – school, and they were like, stores would be open and these other things whenever they want. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's called America. You know, some of this seems to be more about like being a European country. Like, well, imagine if a store could be open whenever it wanted to, and you got people working there. Like, yeah, we do that.
Yeah, dude, Walmart, get something.
But I certainly see the appeal though when you're, you know, when you're living in a part of the world where like, yeah, the sun doesn't go down for months at a time. And it's like, well, it's 4 a.m. What am I going to do? You know, do we feel like we should stick to the schedule and be in our homes pretending it's dark out?
I'll tell you what else, though. There would be kind of a – this makes a lot of sense as like a novel touristy thing. Imagine you're going to carve out 2 weeks to just sort of be adrift and be without time. Now, your experience as a tourist is you go and you go as long as you want. And maybe you even install an app that pays attention to when you're awake and when you're asleep. Scientists have done multiple sleep studies where people are robbed of all the cues of day and night, and their circadian rhythms get all confused. And they notice that the natural sleep day is much faster than 24 hours for most people. And the perception of time changes. It feels like a very, very long time when you have all those cues taken out. So I can understand as a tourist just saying like, I won't even know. It'll feel like a lifetime, but it'll turn out to be 2 weeks. I'm just going to go and live my whatever. And then my app will tell me, hey, you have a flight in 24 hours. And then meanwhile, there would be a bit of a, I guess, a democratizing effect on local businesses, because anytime one, right now, all the businesses sort of try to be open for the same 10 to 12 hour block to try to compete against each other for the same block of consumers that come in. But in this case, essentially, they would run shifts so that any given time there would be a place open, because let's say once at any given time, all people were, let's say, 2/3 likely to be awake and 1/3 likely to be asleep. Then all of a sudden it makes sense to set up multiple schedules that aren't all around worshiping the 8 to 5.
I like the idea that you're staying at a hotel. They're like, Mr. Brushwood, it's time for you to leave. Your 5 days are up. And you're like, are they?
You're like, I'm sorry. What unit do you bill by? And they're like, well, we monitor you. And for every good period of sleep you have, we charge you this much money.
And Brian's like, gotcha. It was the
free vacation.
Let's go to the non-story of the week last week, which was democracy dies in darkness, but BS thrives in sunlight, apparently. Washington Post was the first major newspaper to have this story, the scare story that made the round of the internet, and then a couple days later, the hey, that story's kind of BS made the round of the internet. I'm talking about cell phones giving teens horns.
Oh my gosh. Man, I only barely skimmed this, but what a great headline. I'm not going to lie. That's infectious headline writing. The reality of it, from what little I glanced at, was that basically if you hunch over and look down a lot, you tend to, your bones tend to look different.
I mean, infectious is a great way to describe it, Brian, because it also made me want to throw up. This is just terrible, awful, 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 awful. The story is fine. The story is interesting.
The WAPO one, it says things weren't in there.
Okay. Well, I did not read the Washington Post story. The story that I, when we covered it on Daily Tech News Show, was covering the initial study in Australia or New Zealand or something like that. That basically this was then again aggregated for another series on some other network about like how technology is changing us. So the science of this is that there are protrusions in the like inside your head. So horns is even a very weird thing to say, that is caused from looking down, and it's not harmful. No one's going to die from it. It's fairly unremarkable. You'd probably live your entire life without knowing it. And I would go ahead and suspect that there's probably all sorts of different skeletal and physiological changes that have come along with various different elements of technology, up to and including, in fact, I would suspect that when we went from a predominantly walking or horse riding culture to a predominantly car and public transportation culture, that there were probably some skeletal changes there as well. That being said, the headline writing in this was absolutely shameful. The idea that you would throw in the term that caught the viral element of this was horns, which no explanation of the fact that this is not a radiation thing, blatant pandering to of folks who, you know, might want to bring a religious or apocalyptic element to it, and not to mention absolute it's blank and your kids might be doing it kind of scaremongering. This was awful, awful, awful. It was the hat trick. It was a bad tech story. It was a bad culture story. And it was a bad science story.
However, it was exactly what worried parents want to hear. They crave that so much that it don't matter if it's true. If it's in the orbit of if it's in the solar system of true, then it, and you squint hard enough from Arcturus looking at it, then, you know, somebody somewhere wrote a very effective, I'm not going to say good or bad, a very effective headline to put something out.
I think if you're a blogger like on HuffPo or somewhere else like this, and you're tired of like getting people scared of vaccines, Great job. Great headline. If you're writing for the Washington Post, and then next article your journalist is going to do is going to be some political insight, now I go like, I can't trust you. I don't trust you in your brand, which Washington Post is amazing journalism. It's one of my, you know, for in-depth stuff. I love the WAPO, you know, but I go, I'm like, man, how many other things have I read there didn't pass this kind of scrutiny, but because there wasn't just this research paper, you could say like, no, this has to deal with the back of the neck and the way ligaments attach to the skull. The scientists didn't use the term kids growing, you know, horns or whatever. That just made, to me, it's a brand damaging article.
I will not even attempt to make a counter argument to that.
Well, I think Brian, you're right as far as getting people to click. And yeah, absolutely. I agree. I just say that, like, you know, we all say, what are the limits on our brand and what we want to do? And I think that they do not want the attention they're getting now for, like, wow, you guys are just writing clicky stuff.
Well, here, Bryce, can you go back to that screen that you had?
Sure.
He said, David Sahar, the paper's first author, a chiropractor who recently completed a PhD in biomechanics on the Sunshine Coast, is quoted as saying, that's up to anyone's imagination, he told WAPO. You may say it looks like a bird's beak, a horn, a hook. You had three things that if you even wanted to go, if you were dead set on saying that, oh, no, this quote's the way to go. Horns is deliberately there because it is scare bait for an element of our society that sees technology as, you know, man's final sin. Like the idea that kids are growing horns. This is I found this so gross journalistically. Just and to me, it's like, all right, you know. You're the Sun. You want to run it. You're like Andrew said, some blog aggregator network. I get it, man. Yeah, absolutely. Then I get it. But it's like for that to have made the rounds on the level that it did with horns in the head, kids are growing horns, was irresponsible. Absolutely irresponsible.
Especially in an age where it's not even up for debate that the vast majority of the way people consume news is just by reading the headline and never reading the article, and certainly not reading the original sources.
I know, that's how I do it.
If even just – it's just a bad descriptor because the way that we think of horns are protruding. Like out of the head. Like that's – when you think of horns, that's what you think of, not – like an element of the skull that you're never going to see and you can't feel.
You know, and then it is concerning. Discerning can be is you have one group trying to manipulate everybody else by using scare tactics, you know? And for example, there was an article that came out like, oh, these new artificial meats, they're just as bad as regular meat. And you read the article, it's like, no, they're actually saying that, from what I read was they may not be any different than any other artificial meats, not comparing it to actual meat, because I'm like, I don't know who's been able to do a longitudinal study to compare, you know, heavy consumption of artificial meats versus large consumption of red meat. Nobody's been able to do that yet. But as far as – and then it was you read deeper and you realize this was an anti-GMO group that was putting this out there.
Yeah.
Because they were very critical of it having you know, genetically modified organisms and the GMO in it. And you're like, oh, that's what this is. This is a GMO group that's trying to – You know, and I saw this picked up by blogs and stuff that would normally be pro GMO, but because they're maybe anti artificial meat stuff, will be like, oh, look, this artificial meat, you know, it's bogus. And it's like, well, you just advocated people who you might disagree with because you didn't read further into it.
All right, Justin, would you feel better, like it would be more intellectually honest if they said essentially the same headline, again, focusing on the horns, but they just phrased it as study says, cell phone use making teens horny. Would that work better for you?
I would be I would be 100% more in favor of that headline. And if you could do maybe a series of images of one of the Fortnite dances, you know, just in the headline itself, I would also greatly appreciate it. If you're somebody doing the floss, at least it would be stupid, and you would know that it's stupid. I think we would be living in a better society if it was that and not deliberately trying to scare people into thinking that this is our man's downfall. Finally.
Yeah, playing upon people's fears of this electronic device that's transmitting EMF, which is kind of what many people, that was the connection many people made, is like, oh, it's the radiation, it's doing this. And it's like, nothing's further from that. But, you know, it's, you know,
I must admit, when I first read that headline, I was like, oh, here we go again. It's going to be some kind of crazy X-ray of a cell phone shaped tumor.
But also the other thing that blew me away with this is that it goes to cell phones, which I guess is mentioned in the initial study. But it's like, we've been looking down for a long time. Like, this is like, books also would lead people to
typewriters.
Look down. Typewriters would lead people to look down. Like, if this is such a rapid physiological thing, like, I mean, I guess, are we looking down more? I mean, and you're really going to track that back to 2007? We're 12 years in? And there's this measurable change. I don't know. There was a lot of that really, 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 really frustrated me. And I'm glad that we're talking about it so we can yell at it.
One more story.
Sure.
Yeah.
You've been following sort of the uptick in UFO stories coming out of military pilots, etc.
No.
There has been. I've noticed more of it. That there was some. There was a stories I saw circulating about military folks using the term UFO, and then the clarification of like, literally, we mean UFO the way that it's supposed to be, which is an unidentified flying object, not aliens.
Yeah. So there's been, and I've read some more accounts, and even some more kind of. Military blogs and stuff that aren't prone towards these many flights of fancy, and some people saying like, listen, I'm going to give you an account from, you know, so-and-so who's, you know, a credible person, whatever. So just read his. And there's some really interesting stories about, you know, pilots out there being told, you know, hey, we need you to go, you know, ships getting, let's say, anomalies, seeing anomalies and being like, hey, we're not sure what this is. Sending pilots out there and pilots picking up radar anomalies. In one case, you know, a couple cases like pilots actually seeing things in the water that like appear like surfacing, bubbling out of the water, then floating up into the air and behaving strangely. I read a really cool account of one of this on a fighter sweep had one, and basically details into getting into some of the stories about this. And, you know, I read this and I'm reading through like, this is, you know, fascinating. And, you know, I'm like, one of these things where like, you know, could be everything from some simple explanation to aliens. I don't know. I tend towards the simple one. And I read a very good explanation for saying, looking at some of these descriptions of like, hey, so pilots were responding over an area. They saw something under the water or whatever. They saw some object appear to surface or hover and then fly up into the air, behave oddly. And this is from The Drive said, hey, you know, one of the things that's been used by submarines and naval technology for a while is launching balloons from submarines. And some of these balloons have very exotic shapes. And, you know, if you look at some of these reports, they sound a lot like what could be something launched from, you know, a submarine, where it's basically, you know, a balloon that reaches the surface, then inflates, floats for a while, and then starts to reach a higher altitude and be used to provide data, et cetera. And they show some actually patent filings going back like 40, 50 years ago, and then research over time and how this has evolved into, you know, more sophisticated stuff. And so it could be a case of one hand not knowing what the other one's doing, or some other military power, which is using something that you wouldn't normally think of, you know, somebody launching balloons from underwater, but some of the shapes of them have very interesting shapes because of the radar cross sections, et cetera.
Yeah. And we certainly, there's a long history of this during Project Blue Book. There was a lot of stuff that, 50 years later or 40 years later was declassified as like, over at Area 51, they did a bunch of weird ass stuff, like taking a bunch of mannequins and throwing them out of, mm-hmm. you know, out of planes just to see what happens. It's weird because on the one hand, nowadays that cameras are so ubiquitous, I kind of don't have any patience for stories, full stop, nowadays. It's like, if you don't have video, then don't talk to me. But even worse is we're entering a golden age of deep fakes and simulated video. So even if you do have video, maybe don't talk to me. I don't know really where I'm at now. And it's interesting that the very tools that enabled this sort of, you know, mid 90s to early 2000s golden age of truth are the exact same tools that allow for this impressive bubbling and siloing of information that has us all suspicious of everyone.
Yeah, my, you know, my frustration, and I remember back in the 90s and stuff when I was, you know, kind of full time working with the JREF investigating this stuff, was often that on one hand is you don't want to be the skeptic that dismisses everything and says, yeah, BS. Yeah, it's not true, because that's not a scientific attitude. But the thing that was frustrating was on the other side was, you know, I would talk to people who believed in UFOs and I'd bring up, you know, other, you know, regarding other things like, well, this looked like it was flares, or like, oh, it's disinformation. It's disinformation. It's like, in their course, I mean, their point of view, there was nothing that would convince them it wasn't aliens. And it's like, yeah, well, that's not a reasonable position. Exactly. You know? So, like, I mean, I look at it like, yeah, probably balloons. Like, I think I'm less likely to believe, you know, intergalactic visitors or stuff like this. But, hey, somebody's playing in the simulation. I don't know. But it was a great example, though, because I remember reading the original account going, like, yeah, I don't know what's going on here. I'm not smart enough. I'm not a naval expert or aviation expert to know. And then I read this other article. I'm like, oh, yeah, that makes sense, you know.
I got sent a video this morning from a reader of the Free Political Newsletter who was talking about how his cousin is very into a conspiracy that I had not heard of, but it is that the moon is an alien space station and was placed.
That's no moon.
It literally, that was the number one comment on the YouTube video, which, by the way, was so well produced and was came along with an advertisement for a subscription service for other other conspiracy videos, which made me wonder, like, oh my god, there's a lot of this. A lot of this is out here, and they're putting money into making these little mini explainer videos look really, really good. Which this one did. It looked better than a lot of explainer videos for other topics that I really care about, which means that there's probably more money going into it.
Yeah, you get people who get into this and sort of maybe have a middle school level of science on stuff, and they read something that sounds very, very credible, and then they just take a deep dive into that direction, and they don't back up to say, well, let me go look at the alternative point of view. And then you get like the flat earthers and stuff. You're like, I look across the bay, and it's curved, and yet I see the city. How is this possible? It's like, well, you're only seeing the upper half of the buildings, you know. But you know, it's little detail. But you know, that's the problem is that, and we as people who we accept arguments from authority, and I've watched people try to debunk stuff, you know, using, you know, bad information, which makes it worse. And I don't know. I mean, we all just need to step back and say, maybe I'm mistaken, or I can be.
Hey, look. It is a deep religious commitment that I try to live my life, understanding that I'm very dumb. Yeah. If my thing's right, it is by total accident.
You know, Brian and I have accepted that about you too, Justin. Hey. No, I mean, that's just, it's like when I worked, years ago, for those who know, I used to work for the James Rand Educational Foundation. We had $1 million prize to anybody who could prove they had psychic powers. And I'd get on the phone to somebody who was absolutely convinced that they had powers or whatever. And I'd talk to smart people, PhDs, and other people who were educated. And I mean, not just it's some smart, clever people who had crazy ideas. And I would sit there and I'd get off the phone and I'd be like, what's the dividing line between me and them? What is the separating thing? And I realized the one thing that separated me from this person, because you would talk to somebody about, like, well, maybe you didn't see, like, no, I know what I saw. And it's like, you're like, what's the difference between you and somebody in an insane asylum who thinks they're Napoleon? Like, well, they're crazy. And it's like, yeah, but how do we decide that? And I realized, you know what the difference was? Certainty. And that was the people who had the crazier belief had the most certainty because they thought themselves infallible. And I said, that's how I'll know if I'm going crazy, if all of a sudden, you know, there are things that, like, I tell you, like, everything about me tells me this is to be true, but I know ultimately there is this layer of which I can be mistaken, and I can never, ever, you know, get rid of that layer. And when you say, nope, I know this to be absolutely 100% true, there's no way it couldn't be true, that's when I step back and go, you're not a rational person.
That is definitely the part, you know, in casual conversations, you talk about times that you've been scared by what you thought might be a ghost or whatever. And then, you know, stories and you start exploring. And then for me, there's usually some moment that it flips a switch and I realize this is not open for debate or serious consideration for it to be anything other than what this person believes. At which point I enter new subroutine. Oh, how interesting. In which I just keep saying, oh, how interesting. And to put no energy into it and wait for the soonest off ramp to literally any other topic of conversation, because I know there'll be no benefits, no payoffs. There's no sitting down talking about the malleability of memory. There's no sitting down and talking about standards of evidence, because across this line, you will not tread.
Yeah. Yeah. That's unfortunately often the way you have to do it. And that's once you have that, like, okay, because they're like, oh, so there's absolutely no doubt, whatever. And I'm like, okay, so this is a religious discussion.
Right. Well, in which case I found a bevy of amazing conversational linguistic tactics. Everything from, oh, how interesting, like, oh, that must have felt fantastic, or how strange. Yeah. What did that feel like? Oh, I would imagine looking around and being in the presence of what I thought was a ghost. That must have been incredible. You know, I had an amazing experience. I was playing Final Fantasy VII, and I almost defeated the whole game.
What, not Hearthstone? Oh, that was your music. Yeah, I mean, so again, that's the, we're all crazy. We all, and that's the thing that I think we learned in, you know, both in magic and critical thinking explorations, is you start paying attention to how we personally are deceived and we make these mistakes. And that's step number one, is we have this culture where we train ourselves to spot the flaws in other people's arguments, but we don't like to spot the flaws in our own. If you don't think you have any, you're not paying attention. So let's do picks.
Yo, man, I got a pick. I got a pick that I lost a good 10, 12 hours to this week. It was fantastic. And I want to track down who was the first person to suggest it to me, because I thought it was Brant or Bryce.
It was me.
I am still convinced it was Andrew.
It might be Andrew. Andrew, was it you that recommended Defunct Land to me?
I mentioned it first. I loved it. I've talked to other people, saw it, but yeah, Defunct Land was my big, wow, the internet's wonderful experience.
It is a remarkable, wonderful rabbit hole. And you start with, just look through the stuff they have. Defunct Land is all about theme park attractions that have closed or not around anymore. The easiest thing is to find them talking about something that you know, or one that you went to. I watched the one on Astro World, Six Flags Astro World in Houston. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's a bunch of exhibits I remember from Disneyland, Disney World that aren't there anymore. I worked at a camp teaching magic when I was 19, 20 years old. And we went to Action Park, the notorious Action Park. So that 30-minute episode about Action Park was extraordinary. And I just felt, and then at some point you trust their storytelling enough that you start learning about, like, apparently there are dozens of Santa villages that are that are all abandoned and decayed, and they explained the story of how they happened and how they came in 20-year cycles, and how the upbringing of one generation determined the affection for Christmas for the next one. It's extraordinary. And now I found that they're doing another series called Defunct TV, and if you want to start with anything, start with the 4-part miniseries about Jim Henson. It covers his early works, covers how he sold the Muppet Show, covers how he went into and did Fraggle Rock, and it talks about all of his other projects, including The Dark Crystal, and it paints an extraordinary, I think all four of them total up just over about an hour and a half, I'd say, but it is just extraordinary storytelling. Extremely well produced. I loved it so much.
And this is all on YouTube.
Yes, correct.
Not a streaming thing.
I haven't started Defunct TV. I've watched all of the, he does them in seasons. I've watched all the seasons of Defunct Land, and it is the beautiful, and I said this before, the beauty of the internet is there's a guy that can go out there and take a deep dive into doing documentaries that are better than most of the stuff I've been watching that are produced professionally, whatever that means now. More detail, more depth, and it's niche, but it makes me love the time that we're alive in.
I'll tell you what, man, there is a theme to some of the, I think the second season, never overtly states that it's a scathing indictment of Michael Eisner's handling of the theme park side of things. But boy, oh boy, once an episode, do you get a reminder of how that dude was running the theme park side of things.
If you go into some of the other ones and do sort of similar stuff like Yesterland and all that, you become very aware of, you know, people's opinion. But Defunctland will give Eisner credit where Eisner sort of deserves it, but then we'll then point out, you know, decisions he made.
Yeah, and you are left with sort of an understanding of Eisner's mixed legacy. And I think that's a fair way to put it. I mean, I don't want to take anything away from the genuine good he did for the company. But
amazingly, how much he rebuilt Disney, built it into a financial giant that it was, you know, on the as far as like how the park side and some of the creative side and where it could have gone, you know, there's some frustrations there. But yeah, he may have saved Disney and kept it from getting acquired.
He was the one that did California Adventure, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was he's like, you know what people want when they go to Disneyland in California? Why go to the rest of California? We'll build it into a park here, you know?
It's like, yeah. Were they losing possible visitors to Napa Valley?
I think that is one of the first episodes I watched was the story of what, Limousine Chase or something? Worst... Hands down, the worst Disney ride of all time. And he explains how originally it was going to be like the Rock and Roller Coaster. You had to escape from the paparazzi. And then Princess Diana died. And then they realized they couldn't do that. And so they said, how about we make it very, very slow and we just have a bunch of bad gags. But we only do the gags from, you know, ABC stars because that's who we own and can get the likenesses to. It's extraordinary. Watch as many of those as you can.
We don't want to spend the money, so we're going to build it in a warehouse building, and we don't really want to build animatronics, so we're going to take a bunch of painted plywood.
The creepiest part was when they gave that ride a facelift. I forgot what the new theme was. I think it was a Monsters, Inc. thing. They had all of these caricatures of famous Hollywood people, and so they just put them inside radiation suits to be workers in the Monsters, Inc. factory. So, like, inside, and you could tell from the posture that it's like, that is a Drew Carey caricature wrapped up in a biohazard suit pretending to lift uranium or something.
Oh, Disney's great about that. Like, there was a robot in Star Tours that, like, this robot working on another robot, and it was one of the goose from, like, Country Bear Jam or something, or from, like, the Splash Mountain or something like this. They literally took this goose and just put it over there, stripped it off of all of the fur.
Oh, my God, and it just looked like a horrific robot. Oh, that's amazing. Like,
done.
Superstar Limo. That's the name of it. Oh, yeah. My God. It's great. All of these are so, so good.
Well, hey, speaking of documentaries that aren't documentaries, Andrew Main sent me a text message on Sunday because we have had a fascination with the series Documentary Now. I think we were both in agreement that season two was not quite to the level of season one, and so I had not seen season three despite it being on Netflix. Andrew gave me the thumbs up, and so I dove into it, and it is awesome. I think that there's really not a dud in there. The only real big departure between the two is that previously the previous two seasons it had been kind of a gigantic character a showcase for Bill Hader and Fred Armisen, who were in almost every single episode. This one, Fred Armisen is in the majority of them, but not all of them. But it certainly covers up the star power with a bunch of other awesome guest stars. Really, really good stuff. If you like the previous two, this one features parodies of the Finding Mr. Watterson, the Calvin and Hobbes, the guy who went out looking for the Calvin and Hobbes author. This one, it's Finding Mr. Larson. So he's trying to find Gary Larson from the park. But it's awesome. Like, it is at its best. Documentary Now is always great at showcasing something beyond the gags. Like, it's not just a, like, wackety schmackety portrayal of serious subject matter. They often kind of can take these real emotions and hopefully it's, they land it in a funny place. And there's a lot of that. Fred Armisen is great. There's an awesome a recording of or a documentary of the recording of what is obviously a Rent kind of parody. It's a co-op, the musical, but it's got great stuff. John Mulaney and James Urbaniak, Taron Killam. It's very, very funny.
You know who wrote that?
The co-op?
Yeah.
One, was it Mulaney?
Mulaney and Seth Meyers.
Yeah.
And Seth Meyers has written like half of these, you know, between doing a TV gig and doing this, the writing's great. Like you look behind, you're like, what's part of neat, what's cool about this is you look who's been working on this stuff, and like the bowling one, Tim Robinson's in it and he co-wrote, and you just got like Bill Hader co-wrote some of them. Like you just a really amazing, you know, collection of talent, both on camera and writing these things.
Oh yeah, Brian, if you know, we are big fans of I Think You Should Leave. Tim Robinson is plays opposite the dude what played Dexter.
Mark T. Hall.
Yeah, in a documentary about professional bowling, that is awesome. But Tim Robinson is the like 90s era bad boy of professional bowling, which there was a dude who he's mimicking that used to do the like suck it chant or the suck it like crotch chop.
Pete Weber.
Yeah, Pete Weber. So it's great, but it's also, it just plays right into that perfect zone that Tim Robinson kind of exists in of just like arrogance and awkwardness that is certainly brought to life in the world of professional bowling.
Oh, that's amazing.
I'm not going to lie, with that hairpiece he had on there, I'm like, he could be a leading man. You watch, you know, I Think You Should Leave, you're like, not a leading man. You know, it's like, you know, very interesting. Bryce?
Yeah, I got a pick. So last week, we reported on this on Cord Killers when it was announced, but it finally came out. Netflix got the streaming rights, the first any time ever anyone's gotten digital rights to Neon Genesis Evangelion, a classic mid-90s mech anime. It's about a 14-year-old boy who is called to the new Neo Tokyo 3 by his father to control these giant mechs to save the world from angels, which are these monsters that are coming to attack the planet. And it's really, it's got a lot of depth and maturity. Like, even if it's a mech show about teenagers, it's definitely like a very mature story. But it's great. It really sort of deconstructs the idea of like, oh yeah, we'll just take some teenagers and make them save the world. And it really kind of examines a lot of that stuff of like the realities of killing. And it gets into some weird psychological stuff. You know, the creator said that he wrote it about his depression and as a teenager. And you really sort of see a lot of that come through here. It's really good, and I think they also got some of the films that they did after the series was done. So you have like 26 episodes and then these two movies that kind of supplement the ending. I think it's great. I had never watched it. I have no dog in the fight about all the stuff about these very little changes that they made to the script or to the dub, but I think it's very cool, and now it's on Netflix, so people can see it anywhere. So, Neon Genesis Evangelion.
Cool. I have a pick, and you ever see something, somebody do something, and you go, man, I wish something I wanted to do, but man, they did such a great job and better than I would have done with so much more attention and love that I'm kind of angry at them, but I'm really impressed. And
well, welcome to the bulk of my career as a touring magician. There's a reason I couldn't bring myself to watch most magic acts, because it was either going to be better than I ever could or make me not even interested in trying.
Yeah, so I had seen on YouTube, I'd seen some of these view clips by this person. I saw the headlines for it. I'm like, every time I see something like this on some really cool science fiction or, you know, far out there sci-fi topic or futuristic topic, they get it wrong. They just get it wrong. They don't understand. They don't know. They don't really, they didn't do their research. And I'm not going to click on this because I just don't want to sit there and, you know, have to be like, oh, you got it all wrong. And then one day I'm like, I'm going to click on this article about like alien megastructures or whatever. And, you know, just laugh at how wrong they got it. But they didn't. They got it right. They made points I never even thought of. They did their physics. They did their research. They did a deep dive. And I start clicking into things about like, you know, fast forms of, like space travel, other stuff, all these sorts of things, and really far off, crazy, like post singularity physics and topics about economies and all this stuff. And I've only seen maybe half a dozen of them. They're all amazing. I'm like, I love YouTube because some nerd who's nerdier than me and smarter than me has made these incredible documentaries that just, you know, that on topics with graphics and stuff that are fantastic. And this is Science and Futurism with Isaac Arthur. And at first I had to get into it because I will tell you this, just, you know, his speech is a bit affected. I don't know why, but a few minutes in, you get past that and you get into the knowledge. And that's wonderful about YouTube, is that here is somebody in his own voice telling you amazing stuff that would not maybe have had a chance on a traditional outlets, which would have been our loss. And now it's our gain because this guy's done wonderful stuff. He has a thing on colonizing Pluto and what it would take and all these really cool, if you're into space and thinking about way the hell out, farther out, he does such a wonderful job of, you know, talking about this stuff. His physics is great. His biology is great. He's really, really got a science down. So, you know, he talks about, you know, what's it going to be like if we could have, you know, this super big economy and, you know, expand outwards into the solar system, the universe, and grounded in real physics and stuff. So Isaac Arthur, Science and Futurism, Isaac Arthur. I've only had a chance to watch about a half dozen or so. They're wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. So,
awesome.
Dude. They make me angry. Just makes me angry. So, cool. Gentlemen. It's been petty and weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.